Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
As Europe responds to a series of deadly attacks in Brussels, governments struggle with evolving terrorist financing methods that are becoming increasingly hard to detect. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood filling in for Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, March 22nd. Thank you for joining us. We start today in Brussels, where ISIS claimed responsibility for a series of deadly attacks at a subway station and international airport. In response, authorities in many countries increased security around metros and airports. But what does it take financially for terrorists to sustain their networks and carry out deadly strikes like this one? Those who study terror tactics say these kind of attacks have become less expensive to pull off and therefore harder to prevent. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
For all the destruction they cause, bombs are pretty cheap to make. Bruce Hoffman is director of Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies.
Depressingly, it costs very little money to stage a successful terrorist attack these days.
ISIS income streams include kidnapping, extortion, selling antiquities, and taxing the areas it occupies.
It's precisely ISIS's diversified sources of revenue that make it so dangerous.
But not all attacks are fully funded by the main group. Terrorist cells also tap into social media, sometimes even crowdfunding operations. That's according to Elizabeth Rosenberg at the Center for a New American Security.
It's low level and it's more anonymous. So it's really challenging for regulatory authorities and for law enforcement officials to get a handle on this.
Malcolm Nance is author of a book on ISIS. He says local support is also becoming more important.
Now, this is a hybrid sort of terrorism where the operative himself may self-fund, where the donations may come from someone local.
European nationals can go to Syria or Iraq, then come back and use their existing networks of support, sleeping on a friend's couch rather than spending money on a hotel room under a false name.
He may sell drugs, sell weapons, steal, and do anything to support his operation.
Nance says when you have a small cell of just a few people using mainly cash, they can be nearly impossible to track. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
In Riverside, California, a showdown over an iPhone belonging to a suspected terrorist has been postponed. The FBI and Apple were scheduled to meet in court today at a hearing over whether Apple should be compelled to help the FBI break into the locked phone. But the FBI abruptly called off the hearing, saying that someone outside the government had figured out a way to break into the phone that didn't require help from Apple. That move came just a day after researchers at Johns Hopkins University said they had broken the encryption on Apple's iMessage system and intercepted photos and videos. Matthew Green is an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. He led the research team. He's traveling internationally today, but he joined me from his hotel lobby. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, how are you?
I am very well. So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, Matthew. Are you the third party that the FBI is referring to as they have pulled back on the hearing?
No, I've never been contacted by the FBI. I'm not the third party.
I had to ask. Tell us briefly about the research.
Well, so we started looking at iMessage, which is the built-in text messaging system that Apple includes in all of their iPhones, probably back last spring, because we were very interested in how the encryption works. This has been the subject of a lot of debate, whether that encryption is something that we can use, and whether that's something we're safe using as a society. So we were interested in seeing how secure it really was.
And was that prompted at all by these conversations between Apple and the FBI, or were you working on it before that?
Well, it wasn't prompted by this most recent Apple versus FBI case, but the FBI has been very interested in this encryption problem for a long time, and so that's what prompted it.
And do you think, after the FBI sort of announced its intentions to push Apple to open up its encryption, do you think that spurred a whole other race to kind of get there first?
Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of interest on the part of companies like forensics companies and others in how Apple encryption works and trying to find ways to get around it.
And isn't it fair to say that there is no such thing as perfect encryption?
There's no such thing as perfect encryption, but encryption, when it's done right, can be pretty good. The problem is that a lot of the time we don't do it very well, and that leads to mistakes like the one that we found in iMessage.
And can you describe it a little bit?
So what we found is that iMessage has some flaws in the way they do encryption. They basically do some operations in the wrong order, using the wrong components. And what that does is it doesn't seem like a very big deal, but it opens up the door for us to run an attack where we can recover attachments like photos and videos. It takes a while. We have to basically contact your phone invisibly for upwards of a day. But once we do that, we're able to decrypt those files and view them.
And wouldn't that be exactly the thing that the FBI is hoping to accomplish with the phone that they currently have?
What the FBI is after right now is after a phone that they hold in their hands. They want to decrypt what's on the phone already. Whereas what we looked at is text messaging. So we looked at ways to decrypt files as they're sent over the network.
So what has been happening in the security community? Like, how fevered would you say the race is to crack iMessage encryption? Because it's been talked up quite a bit.
Well, I don't think there's been a fevered race to crack, at least in the academic community, to crack iMessage. In fact, the feeling I get is that most academic researchers like myself haven't been looking very hard at that. I think that if you wanted to find people who are going after that kind of thing, you'd have to look at forensics companies that work for governments and governments themselves. I do think that there are people working on this, but they're not talking about it because they work for the intelligence community.
Right, of course. And can I ask you for your thoughts, your opinion on the importance of strong encryption without backdoors?
I think the thing that we have learned over the last few years is that we're very bad at keeping information secure. Encryption, strong encryption, is basically the highlight. It's the sort of lifeline that we have to make this safe. If you take away the strong encryption, or if you put back doors that weakens that encryption, I'm not really sure how well we're going to be able to keep everyone's information secure.
That's Matthew Green, assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Sure.
On Wall Street today, markets were rattled but are mostly recovered. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On this day of a horrific terrorist attack, we received a different kind of warning about an entirely different vulnerability on a very different timescale. A new paper on climate change science suggests we might see major impacts much sooner than expected, like sea levels rising several meters starting as soon as 50 years from now. We'll leave the physics debate to the pros, but the odds of avoiding a climate disaster are not good. The problem is that it's awfully hard for us to process bad odds 50 years from now. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has this report.
Here's what the balance of evidence suggests about us. You and I, we discount risks in the future. We value things or money today over tomorrow. Matthew Nisbet studies science and communication at Northeastern University.
Whether it's saving for retirement or thinking about the health of your lifestyle, people not only discount a possible future risk, but also tend to have an optimistic bias.
That is, bad stuff happens to you, not me. Sometimes we do respond to risk, if there's a clear bad guy, if there's an example we can identify, or if it's emotional. But the risk of climate change ticks none of those boxes, and it requires us to plan, which our brains don't do well. Seriously. Princeton psychologist Sander van der Linden says the planning section,
specifically the forebrain, developed much later on in our evolutionary history. And so we've been using that part of the brain for a much shorter period of time.
So how to articulate climate change so it's not discounted? It has worked to frame it in terms of economic gains rather than losses. To note, more than 9 in 10 scientists share a consensus. And says climate scientist Richard Alley at Penn State, find new people to talk about it.
Having different voices, surprising voices, Texas ranchers and Marines and an admiral talking about climate change, reached people who otherwise would not have taken it in.
That brings a long-term risk closer. If we hear something from our tribe, we're more likely to act. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
For 25 years now, Teach for America has recruited new college graduates to teach for 2 years, mostly in disadvantaged urban schools. The program has plenty of critics. They say the model leaves the neediest kids in the hands of unprepared teachers who don't stick around very long. And this week, Teach for America announced a big reorganization. It's cutting 15% of its national staff, giving more control to regional offices, and it's changing the way it recruits. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Teach for America says the layoffs aren't about money.
Absolutely not. We are very fortunate to be in a strong financial position.
Rather, says CEO Elisa Villanueva Beard.
What we have learned over time is that this work is 100% local. The needs of a place like New York versus Houston versus, you know, the Mississippi Delta are just so different.
Beard says trimming the central office will allow regional branches to hire more staff and be more flexible. But TFA also has a recruiting problem. During the recession and its aftermath, the group attracted a steady stream of top graduates taking shelter from the bad job market.
As the economy has improved, fewer and fewer new college graduates look at Teach for America as such a great option.
That's Michael Hansen with the Brookings Institution. He says there's also been a backlash against TFA's model of sending elite college grads into struggling schools with just 5 weeks training. The group's own research found that negative criticism influenced almost 70% of potential candidates who chose not to apply. TFA alum Jameson Brewer co-edited a book of critical essays by former members.
I think it's really problematic for the organization, and I think that's telling. They're laying off, they're shrinking, so I think the writing is really on the wall for them.
To fight back, TFA is changing how it recruits. Beard says it no longer works to start talking to college students as they begin their senior year, because by then
they've been sort of engaged with their career aspirations and done lots of internships and are pretty set on what they want to do, and it's a very hard task to try to sort of change their whole perspective.
Now TFA plans to start wooing students well before senior year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Now to Scotland, where the Scottish port city of Aberdeen is known as the oil capital of Europe. The city's gotten rich serving the British oil and gas fields in the North Sea. Its real estate prices are the second highest in the UK, and it has been said that there were as many millionaires there as in London. But the high cost of drilling in the North Sea, combined with the falling price of crude, has hit Aberdeen pretty hard, and the city's prosperous image has started to crumble. From Aberdeen, Stephen Beard reports.
Looking out over Aberdeen Harbour, author Mike Shepherd gazes gloomily at the almost empty dock.
I've seen it a lot busier. There's very few boats to be seen here. It's a sign of the depression we're seeing in the oil industry in Aberdeen.
So when the oil industry was booming, what would this harbour be like?
It would be full.
Shepherd writes books about North Sea oil. He has to these days. It's his only, albeit inadequate, source of income.
I'm a petroleum geologist myself, and I can't find work. I write books in my spare time, but that doesn't make you a living. So I'm waiting for, hopefully, for the oil price to pick up so I can get a job again.
Business is booming here on the other side of the dock, at the food bank on Poynanook Road. Manager Dave Simmers has been doling out more and more parcels of donated food.
In here we've got pasta. Then we would have things like spaghetti rings. What is this? Pineapple chunks.
Simmers says for the first time ever he's seen once-rich oil workers coming in for a handout.
One man arrived in a four-wheel drive Porsche because he had nothing.
But he arrived in a Porsche. Why didn't he sell the Porsche?
It was being repossessed. So that was the tail end of his Porsche days at that point in time.
It isn't easy to feel sympathy for the extremely well paid. At the height of the boom, some of the rig workers were earning $1,500 a day. Mark Russell earned half that amount when he was employed selling communication equipment to the rigs. Still, $750 a day is a very good income. Or was. He hasn't worked since he was laid off 8 months ago. I found him in his local pub, drowning his sorrows in a cup of tea.
That is quite sobering and alarming at times when the outgoings continue to outgo, but there's nothing been coming in for nearly 8 months.
Russell is living off his savings, desperately applying for jobs and dazed by Aberdeen's reversal of fortune.
I think it's shocked a lot of people that it's happened so quickly and so dramatically. I certainly did not expect it to be this, you know, brutal and aggressive, and that really has shocked me.
70,000 jobs have been lost in the British sector of the North Sea over the past year due to the falling price of crude. Production costs are just too high in the often stormy waters off this coast. Dennis Cran is a veteran oil rig director from Texas. He's worked out of Aberdeen for more than 30 years. He's now turned to drilling in low-cost places, much further afield.
I have been working just recently in Tanzania. I've been working in Morocco, Gabon, Cameroon. I have a sniff of some work in Senegal.
So you've been totally unscathed by the fall in the price of crude.
Yeah, I've I'm saying that I'm okay for the moment. My last project ended in January, so I'm looking for my next one.
He says he'll stay in Aberdeen even though he's not drilling off this coast. He's tapping into an onshore resource, the expertise and the contacts built up here in the city. He believes that, like Houston, Aberdeen could evolve into an oil capital that doesn't actually produce a whole lot of oil. In Aberdeen, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This is the only place that they can ensure that the quality of their products remains high.
Clothing companies are choosing to manufacture in the U.S. and not for the reasons you might think. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 41 points, 0.2% to finish at 17,582. The NASDAQ rose 12 points, 0.25% to close at 4,821. The S&P 500 lost a point, about 0.1% to end the day at 2049. Several travel companies headed south after news of today's terrorist attacks in Brussels, Belgium. Expedia rushed down 1.75%. Priceline plunged 2.3%. American Airlines descended 1.6%. And Delta Airlines dipped 1.4%. Results rattled some shares. Accessories maker G3 Apparel shed 19.4% on worse than expected sales and earnings. Bedding retailer Mattress Firm softened 7.1% on weak fourth quarter results. But drug maker Acorn grew 40% on preliminary 2015 financial results and a strong profit forecast for this year. Transocean bore down 5%. Management said drilling would not increase anytime soon. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 1.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Welcome back to Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. Out on the campaign trail, Donald Trump has bragged about the success of one of his business ventures, Trump University. As it turns out, there are questions about those successes. The New York Times reports students there may have been pressured to give instructors positive reviews, which got us thinking. Employees are pretty much constantly asking for reviews about their performance almost everywhere you go. So what do those reviews even mean? Gigi Dubin has this story.
Bank tellers, the cable guy, the mechanic who changed your oil. Chances are good at least one of these has sealed your little interaction with this.
You're going to get a call or you're going to get a survey pretty soon, and I hope what you'll do is you'll give me a 10.
Scott Bretzman is president of Customer Care Measurement and Consulting. He says workers in the hotel industry were notorious for wearing pins that said, "Give me a 10. On a recent tour through Alaska, three different people asked him for a review.
In each of those cases, I had a pretty good experience, and then lo and behold, I was asked to write a review.
Not a coincidence. Adam Alter teaches marketing at NYU. He says plenty of people want to leave reviews.
Especially if they're really, really happy or really, really unhappy.
Alter says companies use this feedback in different ways.
So some will just use the numbers as a threshold just to help them make very broad personnel decisions. Others might even tie compensation to the numbers.
The downside? People find it annoying, Bretzman says. His company did a study that showed customers don't like being asked directly to review someone's service.
People feel coerced. People feel pressured. It's a really awkward, uncomfortable feeling.
In general, most people seem to blow these things off. If your grocery clerk has ever handed you a receipt with a link to a survey circled at the bottom and you ignored it, you're not alone. Bretzman says response rates from receipts range from 5 to 15%. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
In the last two decades, the U.S. has seen some 30% of its manufacturing jobs travel overseas. On the campaign trail, voters are hearing all about it. But one unexpected corner of the manufacturing industry is actually bringing jobs to the U.S., and that's clothing. Startup clothing companies making high-quality garments are setting up shop in U.S. cities, and not for the reasons you might expect. Elizabeth Segrin is a staff writer for Fast Company magazine. She wrote about this re-emerging market. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm very well, and I'm shocked by this news. Clothing manufacturing jobs stabilizing in the U.S., and it sounds like, in fact, companies are deliberately choosing to stay here?
Yeah, they are. And what was so interesting to me as I was doing the research for the story is that they're not staying for the reasons that I thought that they would. Things like ensuring that jobs stay in the country or human rights violations are not part of their clothing manufacturing process. They seem to be staying here for completely other reasons. They believe that they can only make the kind of high-tech clothes and fabrics that they want to make in American factories. And this is the only place that they can ensure that the quality of their products remains high.
Hmm. And is that because they have more oversight or access to better technology or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both. Most of the clothes that we have on the market right now are made of nylon and spandex, which are very kind of old fabrics. And the reason that everybody uses these fabrics is because they're so cheap and they're so abundant. But in fact, over the last 50 years, there's been a lot of technological development in fabric design. And so there are fabrics that, like, for example, feel like cotton or wool, but wick moisture and things like that. And so when a CEO has the ability to go to a factory and see what's going on and see what the chain of command is at these factories and just oversee the process, they're able to ensure that the quality of these different products remains high.
And how big of a market are we talking? How many startups are we talking about?
Well, it seems like it's kind of a bubbling There are several hundred companies that are sort of beginning to spring up, and they're of all different sizes. But I spoke to two companies, one called Yoga Smoga, which is a yoga apparel company, and another large company called American Giant. And these are both companies that are doing very large-scale operations here. They're taking over multiple factories.
So how many jobs are these companies really creating? Is this manufacturing machine automated, or do they need to hire a lot of humans?
It's not mostly machine automated. There are machines that are very high tech that can do things like and ensure that very little material is wasted during the cutting process and things like that. But actually, a large part of every clothing manufacturing process requires somebody to be involved in that process. And so having these factories back at work, that is actually ensuring that a certain number of jobs remains in the U.S.
And those jobs, of course, end up being more high paying Is this a sustainable model? How many Americans are, I mean, these clothes are expensive, right? Are Americans going to pay for $80 sweatshirts?
So at Yoga Smoga, the average price of a pair of yoga pants is $90. And the average price of a sweatshirt at American Giant is also $90. And so at this price point, they're competing with the J. Crews or Banana Republics of the world. They're also emphasizing the durability and the quality of their garments. So really, they're selling a kind of a different product. They're selling a product that they hope is going to last a long time and that that consumers are going to appreciate for their quality.
Elizabeth Segrin is a writer for Fast Company magazine. Thanks so much for your time, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note before we go. A farewell to Andy Grove, the former CEO and chairman of Intel, the company's third employee. And by the way, the guy who decided that Intel should stop making memory chips and start making microprocessors. As a result, Intel became one of the biggest companies in the world, and its chips powered the personal computer revolution. Grove himself survived the Nazi occupation of Hungary, escaped the Soviet crackdown on the Hungarian Revolution, and came to the U.S. as a refugee in 1957. Andy Grove was 79. That is our broadcast for today. Thank you so much for listening. Today, the Dow fell 41 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq rose 12 points, 0.25%. And the S&P 500 lost a point, about 0.1%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I am Molly Wood. Have a good night. We'll be right back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.